Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
The battle over the GOP primary in Arizona's 5th Congressional District continued in court today as attorneys for Christine Jones called a number of voters as witnesses. Those voters' ballots were not tallied as part of the unofficial count that puts Andy Biggs 9 votes ahead of Jones. The Jones campaign is seeking a temporary injunction. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins is covering today's hearing and joins me. Jimmy, several witnesses have already taken the stand today. What do they have in common?
That's right, Steve. We've heard from 7 or 8 witnesses so far. All of these people are voters who have had their ballots thrown out, but they've been thrown out for different reasons. We first heard from voters from Gilbert and Chandler, who told us that they were notified that their ballot was thrown out because they had filed a provisional ballot. They had shown up unwittingly at the wrong polling location. They had been told that they were at the wrong polling location, and in some cases, they were even directed to the correct polling location. But then what happened was the polling workers said, you could fill out a provisional ballot at the incorrect location, and it will count. And of course, those ballots did not count. They were thrown out.
And these ballots can be set aside for a number of kind of interesting reasons. You heard from several young people today had their ballots rejected because of signature inconsistencies.
Yeah, that's right. This is a really kind of lighter moment of the proceedings today. We heard from several young people, a couple ASU students who had had their ballots thrown out. One girl was in her mid-20s, and because of signature irregularities, she first registered to vote when she was 18, and she told me that her signature at that point was kind of bubbly and cute, and now as she's gotten a little older, it's a little more formal, and she said it looked a little more like chicken scratch, but her ballot was thrown out because those two signatures were reviewed and flagged for an irregularity.
I understand that some of the witnesses said they've been fairly popular over the past few days.
Yes, they have. Almost every person that we've heard from today, and so far we've only heard from witnesses that the Jones campaign is calling upon, but every person we've heard from so far has said that they have been contacted over the phone, in person, by both the Jones and the Biggs campaign. So yeah, these people have been getting a lot of attention so far about their ballots.
And Jimmy, why is timing so important? Obviously, there was a rush to get this to court. Why is the timing so important?
Right. First, the Jones campaign filed a motion for a restraining order. That was denied, but they were granted this temporary injunction hearing that we're at today because they're trying to get in as many ballots counted that they think should have been counted before the certification or canvassing that's done by the state. That happens on Monday. So they're trying to get more ballots, even though they don't know which way those ballots will go. They're trying to get more counted because they think, based on the rest of the election results, that things will go in their favor.
And Jimmy, finally, we've heard from a lot of witnesses in favor of, or at least that the Christine Jones campaign was happy to have discussing this and on the stand today. What are the expectations for this afternoon? Who will we be hearing from then?
So far, when the state has come up to kind of defend their practices, they've mainly been trying to make a point that they were not showing any bias. You know, they will ask the witness, did anyone ask you who you're voting for? Were you wearing anything that identified you as one campaign or the other? And so far, the state is just trying to maintain that they have not shown any bias to these voters. This afternoon, I think they're going to go more into their procedural matters. You know, why were people's ballots being thrown out because of signature irregularities? I think they're going to describe that process. I think we may even hear from a handwriting expert. So I think we're going to hear more about the state and county's reasoning behind throwing out these ballots and a defense from them. And they're going to argue that things should stay the way they are.
KJZZ reporter Jimmy Jenkins with the latest on the court fight over CD5 and the GOP primary. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
The vice mayor of Surprise is resigning his position effective tomorrow. Jim Biundo lost his primary election last week and had previously accused the city's mayor of ethics violations for campaigning and fundraising on behalf of 2 council candidates. Matthew Casey from KJZZ's West Valley Bureau joins me for more on this. And Matt, why is Biundo stepping down now? I mean, he's only got a couple of months left on his term anyway.
Well, Biundo's never actually been elected to office. He's been appointed twice, the most recent time in 2014. That term ends at the end of December, and with about 100 days left in office, he says there's just not much time left to get anything accomplished.
I'm not sure that there's a lot I can get accomplished over the next 3 or 4 months in a lame duck situation, so I thought it best for everyone concerned.
Now, last month, Biondo filed an ethics complaint against the mayor of Surprise, Sharon Walcott, for her role in a few campaigns, including that of Biondo's opponent, who then went on to beat Biondo in the primary. The city council then reprimanded Mayor Walcott. Did that have anything to do with his resignation?
The short answer is no. Biondo says that other council members have been asking him about what his future plans are, but he told them he was just mulling it over. He says he did not speak with Walcott or any other council member about his decision to resign, and he denies his relationship or the clash with Walcott played into that decision.
Not really. I would probably say no to that.
So, Matt, when you spoke with Biondo, did he give you any sense of what's next for him?
He wouldn't say definitively whether or not he feels that this is the end of his political career. He said what he wants to do is kind of get back involved with the community at sort of the grassroots level and see where things go from there.
So now what's the process for filling the seat? Could, for example, Jim Hayden, who defeated Biondo in last week's primary, just take that job early?
That could happen if Hayden applies, goes through the interview process, and is ultimately chosen by the council. There are really two processes going forward, one for filling Biondo's seat on the council and the other for replacing him as vice mayor. To fill a seat on council, the city is going to accept applications. There'll be a public hearing where the council will interview candidates, and then the public residents will have time to submit feedback. City officials saying they're eyeing the October 18th regular council meeting for choosing Biondo's replacement on council. As far as the position of vice mayor, the most senior council member automatically assumes that position, and that man is John Williams. But the council could also decide that they want to choose one to serve out the rest of Biondo's term. City officials say so far there's been no word that might happen. Regardless of what plays out in the next couple months, city code requires that the council choose a new vice mayor by January 30th of 2017.
That's KJZZ's Matthew Casey. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Mark.
A 10,000-acre housing development in Buckeye that had stalled during the Great Recession is back on after the land recently sold. The development could ultimately include around 40,000 new homes. Is this project a sign of the Valley's rebounding home construction market? To help answer that, I'm joined by Jim Belfiore, president of Belfiore Real Estate Consulting. And Jim, what do you make of this new development?
Well, my initial thought is it's something that is going to become a lot more common. The housing market in the Metro Phoenix area is growing pretty rapidly at this time, and builders and developers are looking for larger parcels to develop and expand to.
And when you're talking larger parcels, I assume you mean like larger parcels sort of out of the city a little bit.
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, if we look closer in, there aren't any larger parcels. Most of the infill parcels are anywhere from 2 to 20 acres max. And the economies of scale aren't there if you're building on an infill parcel. So builders are being pushed further out. They're building in back in the Hunt Highway, Santan Valley area. Maricopa is a popular destination today. Buckeye, certainly. The larger parcels are further out of the city for sure.
Well, how does that jibe with what we've been hearing about for so long, which is that a lot of people are trying to move sort of back into the city and not be as far away from everything, but be in more sort of a densely packed urban type environment?
Well, I think there was a period of time following the Great Recession and the bursting of the housing bubble where it became more affordable to live closer in. And so with housing prices down, a lot of people were able to afford to live and purchase and rent closer in. Certainly, that's a lifestyle that a lot of people desire, but housing is less expensive the further out you go. And the economic reality of the situation is that most people can afford a home in the suburbs, and a lot of them are not able to afford a higher density home. A lot of people, too, want yards. And so we're going to start seeing a major shift, I think, from where we were just 4 or 5 years ago. People are going to have to go and look further out, and they are looking further out. They're looking for those yards, they're looking for more space, and they're looking for an affordable home, which is just not attainable closer in a lot of cases.
So in your mind, then, is the Valley sort of bracing for a return of the suburbs and a return to some extent of sprawl?
Well, I don't know that I'd call it sprawl, but I think that the reality is the housing market is growing rapidly. Home prices have been appreciating for several years now. In 2012 and 2013 alone, those 2 years, new home prices, net of incentives, increased 20%. Our projections suggest that home prices will increase another 7% next year and up to 10% the following year. The simple reality of the situation is that housing demand outstrips supply at this point, and that will force prices higher. It already has, and more folks will look for affordable purchasing opportunities, and those affordable purchasing opportunities are going to be further out.
Do you get the sense that developers, and maybe to a lesser extent buyers, have learned some of the lessons of the housing crisis and the Great Recession and are maybe going to do things a little bit differently this time when they're building these big subdivisions than what they did, you know, in the run-up to the Great Recession?
Well, I think that the financing rules are a lot different than the financing rules were in 2004 and 2005. I do think people, individuals, potential buyers, have certainly learned a lesson, and we've seen that in their purchasing habits. I don't think we're going to ever get back to the 50 to 60,000 new homes built in a year anytime soon. I really do not foresee that. We see the market topping out in 2020 and 2021. At that time, we should see 25, 26,000 new home permit issuances. That's 50% of what we had in 2004 and 2005. So the market is vastly different. But the main difference, I think, is the availability of money, financing, and as well, certainly buyer habits. Buyers are just much more cautious and more, I think, cognizant of what occurred in the Great Recession, and they don't want to go through that experience again.
Jim Belfiore is president of Belfiore Real Estate Consulting. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
5, 6, 7, 8.
4.
I'm Zoe. I'm the head drum major here at the Desert Vista Marching Band. I conduct the bands, and hopefully they stay together. Like, I love classical music, and I love just feeling the music, and I like seeing everything transform into what it is, and being able to, like, lead it.
And reset. Thank you, guys. Thank you for resetting.
It's different from playing just one instrument and playing just your part and focusing on that. Like, I'm listening to the music as a whole and the marching band show as a whole, and it's just a different perspective, and I really wanted to strive to be the one who's in charge of that perspective.
That's Zoe Clevenger conducting the Desert Vista High School Marching Band. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note. The show at kjzz.org. You've probably been stung or bitten by something, whether it's an ant, a bee, or something more dramatic and damaging like a scorpion. University of Arizona entomologist Justin Schmidt has been stung nearly 1,000 times by various insects in the course of his research. It's been part of his work in quantifying pain and figuring out what humans can learn from insects on societal evolution. Justin, how did you get started with this willingness to get stung?
It was all pretty much just happenstance. As I was doing research, wow, you'd get stung and I'd record them. I wouldn't record the number because sometimes, you know, it's too many to run out of fingers and toes. So I just, you know, count, well, it's about 20. But yeah, very little of it was actually planned to be stung. You know, those are only the ones that I'm basically a coward. And so I don't really like to get stung, but I like the results of working with stinging insects.
Well, if you're basically a coward, then how do you get yourself mentally ready to get stung that many times?
I don't really get mentally ready. It's kind of interesting. It's like in the doctor's office, you know, you're in there and you're about to get an injection for, you know, immunization or whatever. And, you know, you always have this kind of dread. And the best thing you can do is bring a comic book or something and try to read something lighthearted so that you're not thinking about it. And when they stick you and it's all done, and you say, oh, good, what a relief. And it's kind of the same sort of thing. I'm into what I'm doing and focusing on that, and last thing I want to focus on is, oh my goodness, I'm going to get nailed here in the process.
What was the first insect you were stung by?
A bite, actually, by forest ants that lived in the Northeast. They don't actually sting, but they bite, and then they'll spray formic acid in you, which kind of, you know, when you have a wound with formic acid dumped in it, it feels like a sting. But then after that, when I was about five, I was kind of exploring as a young biologist, entomologist. Of course, I didn't know that at the time, but I was exploring a bumblebee colony in the backyard. You know, it wasn't much for a five-year-old to do, and mama kind of chucks you outside so you can get some exercise and fresh air. And I'm kind of watching them and digging around. Where are they going in this wood pile? And, well, they sort of took umbrage and taught me a lesson or two about keeping your nose in your own business.
Why is this research important, to know more about insects, to go into their colonies, and to frankly shake up what's going on with their existence? What can we learn from that? What are you hoping to learn from that?
Well, one of the things that I'm really interested in is sociality. We're, of course, the ultimate of social species, you know. So I'm really interested in societal solutions. And the insects have a large number of solutions for them. The ants are social. Many of the bees are social. Many of the wasps are social. And so what I'm interested in doing is comparing, you know, the sociality of the different groups, us and insects and mole rats and, you know, various others, and figuring out, you know, why they are so advantageous. And then after that, okay, what enabled them to become social? You know, had to have certain tricks.
Have you had a situation where you have been stung and you thought, well, I'm not exactly the winner on this one in my research. That one hurt, and that one's going to hurt for a while.
Yeah, I think the only ones that I've had of that type of nature are repetitive things. I spent a long time working, about 25 years, on honeybees. And much of the research on honeybees I had already completed, so I was just doing routine, you know, work with honeybees or something of that sort. So there is nothing I'm really urgently trying to find out. And then I get stung up and say, oh my gosh, I got these 50 stings, and what did I get out of it? I got a little bit of misery and a little bit of puffiness on my wrist, and that's about all. It's certainly nothing good. I didn't make any major discoveries or anything. But the ones that have really hurt me, other than that, are usually uniques, where I have a wasp nest and I've never seen it before, and I have to get the material. And yeah, I get stung up pretty badly, because sometimes I'm out, you know, goofing off on kind of a leisure day off, and I run into this opportunity and say, well, I haven't seen this before. No chance to go back and get my armored bee suit and all that. We got to do it. And, you know, well, I get kind of stung up and they teach me a lesson or two, but I get my material. And so overall, I'm kind of satisfied in the end that it was worth it.
I was thinking back to the film Jaws. I don't know if you've seen this, where
the three men are
on the boat,
the classic,
and they compare each other's scars. Is there a scar you have? Is there something that people want to say, wow, Justin, what was that one like? Or can you see on your bare arms what it looks like?
No, we actually have no signs of anything from the stings. The only sign I have is I have a shattered ankle from falling off a cliff when I was working on honeybees and studying them. So that was the auxiliary collateral damage. But nothing, you know, the stings themselves, in fact, that time I never even got stung.
U of A entomologist Justin Schmidt, as part of his research, he's been stung or bitten by insects about 1,000 times. Have you seen the hashtag normalize breastfeeding on social media? It's becoming a lot more popular as breastfeeding rates continue to rise in the U.S. Breastfeeding is seen as the healthiest option for babies.
And a matter of liberation for some mothers. And as the show's Lauren Gilger found, it doesn't look like it's going anywhere anytime soon.
When she was pregnant with her first son, Leanne Contreras registered for a nursing cover so she could breastfeed in public.
And with Andy, no way.
Contreras is sitting in a temporary bookshop set up at a La Leche League of Arizona breastfeeding conference with her second son, Andy, on her lap. Back then, she said she wasn't even all that concerned about breastfeeding her children.
I didn't really know anybody that had breastfed.
But once she did it, she says it quickly became a passion.
I mean, it's so special because it's just a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to bond that way with your baby. Like, you just grew that baby inside of you, and he's such a vital part of you. I mean, physically, emotionally, everything.
They get to know their infant in a very intimate way that helps them to become a parent later on down the road.
Desiree Allison is a certified lactation consultant at the Arizona Breastfeeding Center. She works with new mothers and babies who struggle with breastfeeding at the center and as a leader for La Leche League of Arizona, a national nonprofit breastfeeding support group. She says most new moms assume that breastfeeding their children will be easy.
I think they think because it's a biological process that they think it's going to be simple, that it has to be easy.
But that's not always the case. Allison works with women who struggle with low milk supply, oversupply, infections, tongue-tied babies, and more.
It does take a little bit of practice.
Still, more and more women in the U.S. are breastfeeding, according to a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. According to the CDC, 81% of mothers in the U.S. are breastfeeding their children at birth. In Arizona, that number's even higher, 85%.
We have seen a huge culture change in what our patients are asking for when they come in.
Janet Pierce-Hollett is a lactation consultant and patient family educator for Banner Health. She says now mothers are coming into the hospital expecting to see a lactation consultant.
It's not us educating at the bedside and trying to preach the benefits of breastfeeding. Now our patients are coming in with that basic knowledge. They just want to know how to do it.
Ask why and you'll get a lot of answers. Access to care, education, it's generational. And to Pierce-Hollett,
a big part of me feels like a lot of this is because of Facebook.
At last check, almost 100,000 people were talking about the hashtag Normalize Breastfeeding on Facebook. And Pierce-Hollett says it's creating community.
These women who would maybe not otherwise know each other are talking to each other.
But according to the CDC, that's not getting enough moms far enough down the road. Only about half of babies are still being breastfed at 6 months of age. The agency recommends breastfeeding for a year or more. Pierce-Hollett says as mothers head back to work, breastfeeding can get more difficult. She says the Affordable Care Act now mandates that employers provide space and time for employees to pump. But
unfortunately, the mandate does not include paid time.
So she says many mothers, especially hourly employees, stop breastfeeding then.
You might find that she gives up pumping at work in order to not risk losing her job.
In Arizona, about 55% of babies are being breastfed at 6 months, the CDC says. That number is up almost 10% in our state since 2014. And according to Ann Whitmire with the State Health Department's Women's, Infants, and Children's Program, or WIC, that's partly because they've done so much work to make sure healthcare providers, employers, child care centers, and mothers all have the resources they need to support breastfeeding.
The Arizona WIC program, 10 years ago, we had one lactation consultant. Now we have 90.
She says 60% of babies born in Arizona participate in the WIC program, and they're seeing the rates of even low-income mothers who choose to breastfeed go up as well, especially as the Affordable Care Act has provided some support for nursing mothers, like breast pumps.
It's making access to care a little bit easier for moms.
Allison says it's still easier for upper-middle-class women to breastfeed, but her field is now focused on expanding their scope.
We want access for all moms.
It was everything to us.
The first time Leanne Contreras called the Leche League of Arizona's 24-hour hotline and asked for help, she was having a hard night.
You know, you're stuck in that, I'm so alone, it's 2:00 in the morning, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do, he's still crying.
She says she waited until 6:30 in the morning to call and immediately felt relieved.
It was someone saying, I know what you need, I can help you.
Now, because it made all the difference for her, she's training to become a support group leader herself.
I want to create that community for other mamas. I want to be able to be the mom on the other end saying, you can do this.
For the show, I'm Lauren Gilger.
The University of Arizona Institute for LGBT Studies is hosting a first-of-its-kind conference this week. It's called Trans Studies, an International Interdisciplinary Conference on Gender, Embodiment, and Sexuality, and includes presentations on transgender linguistics and approaches to transgender community health, among others. With me to talk about the conference and its significance is Eric Plemons, an assistant professor of anthropology at U of A and chair of the conference program committee. And Eric, to you, what is the significance of this event?
There are a couple different ones. So on the one hand, I think there's an important institutional significance. Here at the University of Arizona, we've invested an incredible amount of resources in starting up this program by attracting faculty members, including myself, who have this specialty to the institution. But in a broader sense, I think it really captures the fact that there has been a lot of interest in transgender people, medicine, policy, law, across a number of different fronts, including, you know, popular culture. We see a lot more popular representation in the media, sports, this bathroom controversy that's happening in multiple states across the U.S. And there are many, many people working on the emerging field of transgender studies. So it's an opportunity to bring those people together and put them into conversation.
Why do you think it's important that academia be focusing on this? I mean, what's the relationship sort of between what folks are studying at colleges and universities and sort of what's going on in the world sort of outside academia?
Well, I'm a social scientist, so I think that any kind of social phenomenon is worth knowing more about. Certainly any time you're in the business of making legislation, say, for example, about public restroom use, or you're creating public policy, for example, about who can access what kinds of medical services under federal or private insurance, it's important to know something about those people, and it's important to understand why these things become controversial at the times that they do.
Are policymakers currently looking to the kind of research that you and others in your field are doing? Or because it seems like some of the laws that are being passed and laws and ordinances that are being proposed still sort of come from a more of a visceral reaction.
Absolutely. And so we need to have some other kind of discourse enter the scene. Because if it's simply, I don't like this because I don't know anything about it, well, there are people who know quite a bit about it. And yes, so for example, at the conference, there are many people who work on law and policy or people who work on history. Myself, as a medical anthropologist, I am involved in conversations about the kinds of services that are offered at different hospitals and different insurance policies, for example. So increasingly in my own work, you find as new insurances are being offered, for example, people who know nothing about this population are in charge of setting rules about it, and they go seeking information because they want to do their jobs well. And that's when a person like myself says, oh, yes, I actually do research in this field, and I can help you do that better.
What do you hope that attendees of this conference get from it and take away from it?
Well, one of the biggest things for those people who are coming as academics is to be connected with other people who are working in institutions across the country and around the world, and they have not had a chance to see each other's faces and connect across these geographic distances. So we're really hoping for that. We're also hoping that in the long term, this can be the beginning of starting a transgender studies association. So a professional association, not unlike the one I'm a member of, the American Anthropological Association, that provides a way for people to connect to each other's scholarship, but also mentorship for younger scholars with those who are more established, a regular meeting that will allow people to share work and to build their professional portfolio. And we also have folks coming who are not academics, who are artists and performers, who are activists. Many members of the Tucson community are planning to attend. And so we're hoping that those people can also be connected both to this emerging scholarship and to each other in the networks that they run in, so that the artist folks can be connected to artists and activists to activists.
Eric Plemons is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Arizona. The Transgender Studies Conference continues in Tucson through Saturday.
Skateboards are a unique way to express individuality and personal style, and Douglas Miles, one of New Times 100 creatives, has used them for his canvas. Miles is the owner of Apache Skateboards and a highly regarded muralist. His art also reflects the deep connection he feels to his heritage, and he joins me to talk more about that. Douglas, how important is it for your art to say something deeper?
If my art has a certain feel or look to it, and I'm going to talk about social justice, the way I look at it as an artist, there's no difference between what I'm doing and what Woody Guthrie did. There's no difference between what I'm doing with my art and social justice issues and Bob Dylan did, or Bruce Springsteen, or Stevie Wonder, or Marvin Gaye. It takes only the best artists, though, can actually combine politics and art seamlessly. Because before you realize it, you're popping your head along to the music and you're learning something in the process.
And how did skateboards become a part of your artistic expression?
Well, my son, Doug Jr., over 10 years ago, maybe almost 15 years ago, really, started to skateboard. And I remember when I was a kid that I used to skateboard too. And I eventually bought a blank skateboard and I painted him one. And the rest is Apache history.
But the expression part of it, is that a big enough? I mean, you're someone who's doing murals too. When you look at this, do you like to use small? Do you like to go big? Does it fit into that at all?
Well, when I started painting on skateboards over 15 years ago, at that time, you know, I was selling art and I was traveling and doing more typical, traditional, you know, rectangular canvases and drawings and paintings. but I was always looking for something different, something new, a new form or medium, if you will.
And how many of those have to do specifically with your heritage?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with my heritage. I mean, it's who I am. I live in Arizona. I'm from Arizona. Mm-hmm. I'm San Carlos Apache. I'm Akumil Otham, out from Gila River. I don't think I'm never going to get away from that.
So how much of what you do, whether it's with skateboards or graphic novels or murals, is about you expressing your artistry and your heritage, and how much of it is trying to tell a story that may have been buried, maybe people just aren't aware of?
I don't know. I never really thought about it. I never really thought, well, how much of my story is about an Apache perspective, mm-hmm. or a Native American ethos, or a story of people that fought the United States government for freedom. And I really never thought about how much of it is or isn't. But I think a lot of it is about Apache history and a Native American ethos in it.
But art can be received so subjectively by every single person. Are you hoping when you do your art, though, that people look at it as more than just, wow, this is intriguing, fascinating art, and they try to dig deeper into what the origins may be?
Well, I hope people look at my art the way they listen to music, really. I want them to look at my painting and think of it in terms of, it's a 3-minute song by Chuck Berry, or maybe it's a 3-minute song by the Rolling Stones, or a 3-minute song by Van Morrison and Them. I want people to see it and immediately feel it, feel that, or whatever it is that they're talking about or singing about or struggling with, because a lot of popular music is really also about struggle.
Is there an uphill battle to be an artist in the West with your background, considering the mythology of the West, the Old West, the Wild West, whatever it may be?
I think there is an uphill battle for Native American artists in particular that sort of veer from the norm of talking about traditional or typical historical or even romantic Native American and Western art tropes. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the historical romantic West and you don't paint in a historical romantic style like I don't, and I think it is uphill battle. At the same time, though, I think it's important for artists to paint what they think and feel.
I want to read you a recent tweet I saw at Apache Skateboards, your business, read below a photo, 4 males mm-hmm. holding their skateboards. It says, quote, "because Fritz Schulder never had a skate team." Now, Fritz Schulder, a well-known Native American artist in his own right, was that phrase positive, sarcastic?
I think it's a phrase that I created as I think about how influential one artist can be in the Native American art community. But that artist has been influential. An artist like Fritz has actually been influential for going on 30 years now. And I think it's time to start looking at other Native artists that are influential. Does that mean me? Maybe yes, maybe no. Nobody doesn't have to look at me. Nobody doesn't have to care. But I know one thing. Fritz Schulder did not travel around for the last 15 years visiting different Native American communities with a skate team like I have with An Apache Skateboards, and still had a fine art career, and still designed skateboards, and still worked in the Native community, hired skate punk bands, hires and sponsors young Native American skateboarders. Fritz is an amazing guy. I'm just saying. He never had a skate team, though.
Artist Douglas Miles is the owner of Apache Skateboards and one of New Time's 100 creatives. You'll be hearing from others on the list on upcoming editions of the show.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.